Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into some breaking news stories here. Of course, the big story being the unraveling of the 42-year-long dictatorship in Libya under Muammar Gaddafi and his family, protected by an inner circle of North Korean and East German-trained female bodyguards and an outer ring of African mercenaries. He's using unprecedented tools of military power against civilians, bombing, strafing, using his air force, and of course using these mercenaries to go around in pickup trucks and shoot anything that moves. And of course he was on television today revealing, which should not be a secret, that he's somewhat bizarre. But there's a lot more to this story. We'll be joined later in the hour by other guests here today. We'll try and, in our fund drive, continue to do as much programming as possible, as little fundraising as necessary, in the hope that you'll keep supporting this program. And I'm speaking with Ali Abdollatif Ahmida, who is chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He is the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ali Abdollatif Ahmida.
Thanks, Ian, for having me.
And clearly, the headlines today are about this bizarre address by Gaddafi, where he ranted against the citizens of his country, calling them cockroaches, saying that they were hallucinating on drugs, all kinds of insults to the people who he's ruled with an iron grip for 42 years. As a Libyan, and now an American, of course, does it bother you that we have seems to be so belatedly discovered what a hideous dictatorship this is, how ruthless this man is? I mean, it seems like we've been doing business with him for some time, even though Ronald Reagan dropped a couple of bombs on him.
Yes, I do. I think this is really outrageous. And specifically, I think since the rapprochement between the Bush administration, George W. Bush administration, and the Libyan regime, when he made the deal to compensate the families for the Lockerbie, you know, airline bomb, and also to collaborate with the United States in security matters, including terrorism. And I think he complied with all the demands that the United States government and the Western government put in front of him. However, it looks like we always forget the people or Libyan society, as we did, of course, quite often, and as in the case of Tunisia and in Egypt, where we, you know, the government supported these regimes for a long time, and didn't pay attention or try to engage the regime to open and also you know, strengthen civil society. And this is a country that's, on paper, one of the richest in Africa. It has only 5 million people, but also it has 21% unemployment rate and one of the most corrupt regimes in the area. So you could see that very, very much, as you you know, phrased it, one should be outraged by not following up with the regime internally.
But the one thing that you didn't mention there in terms of the regime and the country of 5 million with this enormous amount of unemployment, it also sits on a huge amount of oil. Apparently the sovereign fund is about $100 billion in spite of all the billions that Gaddafi has wasted on these vainglorious projects and all the enormous amount of money invested in military equipment. This is a country that has generated an enormous amount of oil wealth over the years.
Yes, and that's exactly. The revenues for the state mainly comes from oil. Libya has the largest reserves in the whole continent of Africa, and that allows the actually, this is one of the reasons to explain the dictatorship, because It gives the government and Gaddafi's, with his grandiose vision, autonomy from civil society where, you know, taxation is not really needed as much, but also the, you know, the revenues from, and instead relying on oil revenues from the oil companies, that allows him to have this autonomy, which became really one of the bases for, you know, authoritarian regime like his. But at the same time, it allows him to buy off Western interests and Western government by allowing multinational oil companies to continue to function in Libya, and therefore they paid lip service to the the human rights and also democratic rights of the citizenry in Libya.
Again, I'm speaking with Ali Abdelaratif Hamida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England and the author of The Making of Modern Libya. Now, do you think that Gaddafi played the West? He played Bush and Tony Blair. He made the deal over Lockerbie. He paid the families of the victims $10 million apiece, but given the amount of money that he's thrown away and him and his family have embezzled, it's essentially small change. He gave the U.S. and British intelligence people information about the AQ Khan nuclear network and suddenly became our new best friend. But for the Libyan people, having the world's biggest democracy on your side, that didn't translate, did it? I mean,
It did not. And not only just our government. Imagine how much we discuss about Libyan society. We don't really know much about it. And even our scholars, were confined to just reference to this leader and how eccentric and how bizarre and how funny sometimes and how, you know, crazy sometimes is. And, but we don't know. We are in the dark when it comes. What about Libyan society? Who made that society? What's their culture? What's their, you know, writers? What's their women organization? What are their creative energy? What's their music? What's their, we don't see that. And so we reduce it to the great leader, and he is Libya, and Libya is oil, and that's it.
But he internally, even though he was in bed with Western oil companies and the new friend of George W. Bush and Tony Blair, he still played the anti-American, anti-Western card. After all, the speech that he just made, this strange speech that he made today, was right in front of the bombed-out building that almost got him. Yeah. And then there's, of course, this big statue that he put there. So does that work anymore? I mean, will it work?
Well, it worked in the past. And we have to also not to lump the 40 years together in one model. This, Gaddafi's and the three junior officers who came from a middle to lower middle class background in 1969, for 10 years, they were very popular. They rode the sentiment of Libyan frustration with the West, not recognizing the fact they went through a colonial, brutal period that may be the worst in Africa, and that almost half a million people perished, including 60,000 in concentration camps. And he wrote that. He nationalized the oil companies. He asserted he got rid of military bases. For that period, anti-colonialism and asserting Libyan nationalism worked well. But that language, that rhetoric worked in the 1970s. And now the regime completely isolated, its social base is so limited to the point that Gaddafi had to rely on mercenaries to fight his war in against his dissent and against his democratic uprising. So I think in that sense, we have a different regime from the 1970s. One more also observation, Ian, I think we have to bring it to your listeners. The fact that Gaddafi is used to the fact he used an iron fist heavy, you know, carry a big stick and bribe some, but hit the sand very, very hard. So he thought that he could weather this storm by really hitting those what he called people who are protesting against him, as perhaps like the Syrian regime when it killed 20,000 people in the town of Hama, or Saddam Hussein when he gassed the town of Halabja in Iraq. So he's used to that model, thinking that this is another crisis, I could hit them hard, and I survived for 42 years, I could survive more. He's wrong. The time changed.
So given that he's got these African mercenaries from Chad and Niger and other countries, apparently he's offers them, what, $1,000 a day or something, or a week? I can't remember what the figures are.
Yeah.
And he's also got this bizarre kind of inner cadre of female bodyguards who the North Koreans and the East Germans trained. What good is that going to do him? Is it going to be like the Samson complex where he takes the whole thing down? My feeling is that this family, even though the sons may be able to, and may be able to escape to join their many billions of dollars they've got stashed in offshore banks, I'm not sure this family's going to escape. I think they're going to end up like the Ceausescus, don't you?
Well, I think you're quite right, Ian. I think the regime, it's over for the regime now. Even if they survive a little bit long, even if they kill more people, and unfortunately I could foresee that, I think it's over for it. It's lost its legitimacy. It's there was nobody believing in it except the diehard close knit of his cousins, his sons, and a few groups around them, and the security brigades. I think it's over, but it might take a little bit longer before it dies. As far as the legitimacy of the regime, I don't think we can think of it as it used to be in before. He, knowing him, very likely one possibility is he will either commit suicide or maybe will be killed like Ceausescu in Romania. That's very possible. Now, we cannot say that's going to happen tomorrow or next year or maybe 2 years. Let's hope not. But the repression is going to be very ugly in Libya.
Well, surely it's not going to take years and months. It sounds like it may be weeks at the most. I mean, look how quickly the critical mass formed in Egypt and is forming in Bahrain and did previously happen in Tunisia. This phenomenon of people power is a powerful organism, even though...
Yeah, that's true, Ian, but keep in mind that there are differences. This is an earthquake that is going to come to the region one after another. There is different context in each country. Even, I would say, the Arabian Peninsula is going to be impacted as well. So in Libya, there is the difference between Tunisia, Egypt, and Libya. In the case of Libya, the army has been dissolved very much and weakened so much to being ineffective because he feared them. The second factor is that one of the worst consequences of the Libyan regime in the last 25 years is that he destroyed trade unions, he banned, of course, political parties from the beginning, and he even... weakened and corrupted the public institution like health and education. I could give you an example. I came out of a very solid education, public education in Libya, and when they sent me to Egypt as a top student, and then I came to America, and I could stand in my own and compete as a graduate student. The young Libyan and women, despite literacy rate in Libya is one of the highest maybe in the region, the most literate society maybe, it's very, very defective and very corrupted institutions. And I think that that's really a major difference between Tunisia and Egypt.
Well, again, I'm speaking with Ali Abdellatif Ahmida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England, the author of The Making of Modern Libya. Since he Gaddafi comes from a tribe that, right, named it's he, which from which he gets his name,
and Gaddafi,
it is a tribal society. So, give me a sense of the tribal loyalty, if there's any glue left there, because it seems like so much of the country is turning against him.
Well, you know, we have to temper that notion that we have about Libya a little bit. It's true that Libyan society has major tribes, especially in the countryside of Cyrenaica, or that's the eastern region, and also southern Libya and maybe the Green Mountain. But we shouldn't let your listeners think that tribes being pre-modern. We're talking about a very modern economy, but with the weakness or the weakening of the, let's say, the political parties, the professional organization, the trade unions, the tribe and the mosque were the last institution left to people to regroup and have some support. So, and he manipulated these tribes also, armed some and suppressing others and play divide and rule among them, and by way of trying to ensure his survival and his regime. So in that sense, the tribal factor is real in Libya, but it has a different quality than, say, something in 1950 or 1940s.
So if he's if there are these differences, both tribal and I imagine political. Yesterday, I spoke to a former deputy director of the State Department Intelligence Bureau who studied this region for about 12 years. He said that the Benghazi area is more Islamist, and that there's always been resistance there to Gaddafi. Is that you know, you said that there's tribal and religious differences. Explain the religious differences. Or you said that there was only the mosque was available, the tribe and the mosque. So give me a sense of the tribe, of the mosque.
Well, I think Libyan Islam, like the rest of North African Islam before the 1980s or 70s, is really a mainstream moderate Islam. But because of repression, alienation, and unemployment, a lot of the youth were radicalized, and they became more advocates of a new brand that's really alien to North Africa in general. And I think in the eastern region, among the urban youth who are unemployed and unemployed and alienated, they converted to this movement. I don't think it's as widespread as it used to be in the 80s and the 90s, especially after some of them went to Afghanistan. However, having said that, we have to also to keep in mind in Libyan society there are intellectuals, there are women activists, and Libyan society is you know, in general, I think I would say it doesn't have an extreme ideology to speak of as the neighbors. So in that sense, I don't think that's a problem to deal with right now. However, the eastern region has this population. Most of the population are located in western Libya. Benghazi, too, has 1.5 million, but Tripoli has really a large, you know, greater Tripoli has almost 2 million or so. And the issue is not the Islamists. I think the issue is the vacuum that was caused by years of repression where society has intellectuals, technocrats, journalists, judges, and so that need to kind of have a lot of energy to strengthen its organization. But from what we've seen, you know, recently in just a week, I think Libyan people surprised us. Tremendous awareness, tremendous courage, tremendous daring to challenge the regime. And we haven't seen anything despite the regime claim of some extreme Islamist movement or secessionist movement, as he accused the eastern region of doing. I think what we've seen is a new wave of awareness that this is a change for the whole country. And so far, we should believe them. The only problem remains for us as in the United States, however, is the government cut all kind of communications with the outside world, and there is no journalist there. So we have a lot of rumors and psychological warfare between the government and the democratic movements now, and there's a lot of things that need to be kind of verified. But other than that, I think so far the tribal factor hasn't been a big problem. He tried to manipulate it in his speech, but I don't think it's working so far. I think people are showing a lot of awareness.
So just in closing, Ali Abdellatif Ahmida, the State Department intelligence official yesterday was saying that we've seen the easy ones so far, Tunisia and Egypt, but some of the tough nuts are going to be cracked coming up now in Libya and then perhaps later Syria and even Saudi Arabia, and you alluded to that too. You've got regimes like the Assad regime. You mentioned Hama, where the father killed 25,000 people.
Yes.
And Gaddafi is equally capable of doing that. So the two things to look at, I guess, now are, one, how much bloodshed is going to be shed in order to get rid of this guy, and he probably will end up the way that Ceausescu did in Romania. But two, the enormous vacuum that will result. In Egypt, the army was a strong institution, and they were the ones that showed Mubarak the door. They're basically back in charge. The army, he kept weak. The country's been divided and manipulated against each other. What's left to take charge?
That's what worries me a little bit. But I hope that we, Libyan, especially then, not the outside diaspora, who I tell you sometimes they think, they inflate their importance. But the people who are leading this courageous social movement and taking matters in their own hands, we cannot go back to be romantic about the monarchy period. I think what's important is to start talking about what kind of vision, what kind of specific demands needed in post-Gaddafi Libya, and also not to take revenge like him did before, and try to not to lump everybody as a Gaddafi bureaucracy or Gaddafi's supporters. So people who are defecting now, quite in a large number, will continue to be assured that they will be respected and not will be punished, or they will have vendetta committed against them. Larger debate about post-Gaddafi Libya, I would claim that hasn't even started. And that worries me a little bit, because there has to be, you have to be for something, not just you are against something, but you have to be for something.
Well, let's stay in touch then, Ali Abdellatif Ahmida. And I appreciate your insight, having grown up in Libya and stayed in touch with the country. You go back there every year. It's very, very. We're very grateful here to get your expertise on this country that is emerging from its 40-plus year-long dictatorship.
Thank you, Ian, for having me. I really enjoyed this interview. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And hello again. I'm Ian Masters, and I was just speaking then with Ali Abdellatif Ahmida, who is the chair of the Political Science Department at the University of New England. He's the author of The Making of Modern Libya, Forgotten Voices, Power and Agency in Colonial and Postcolonial Libya, and Post-Orientalism, Critical Reviews in North African Social and Cultural History.